Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 237 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Mimi Calvati speaks with John Greening about losing her Persian origins in an Isle of Wight boarding school, the creative benefits of constrained poetic forms, the neglected role of abstraction in English poetry, and why she co-founded the Poetry School.
Mimi Calvati was born in Tehran and has worked as an actor and director both there and in the UK. She grew up on the Isle of Wight, the setting for several of her poems, but it was not until the success of her 1990 pamphlet Persian Miniatures that she turned to poetry full-time. Carcanet Press have since brought out a series of highly praised collections, notably Mirror Work, which won an Arts Council Award, The Chine, The Meanest Flower, shortlisted for the T.S. Eliot Prize, and The Weather Wheel. There have been three selected volumes, most recently a so-called Very Selected from Smith Doorstop. She's edited several poetry anthologies, including some from the Poetry School, of which she was the founder. She also co-founded the Theatre in Exile group, was RLF Fellow at City University London, and has been Poet in Residence at the Royal Mail. Mimi Calvati is recipient of a prestigious Cholmondeley Award and Fellow of the Royal Society of Literature. Mimi, perhaps you could tell us a little bit about that theatre group that you set up in Tehran, you founded.
Oh, yes, John. Oh, it was a very exciting time. This was before the revolution in Iran. And I arrived in Iran originally intending just to stay for a summer holiday. And I'd recently left drama school. And then I met somebody who said, would you like to work with some actors here? And I said, well, I can't. I speak no Farsi. And they didn't speak English. And they said, oh, well, give it a go anyway. So I thought, well, all right. So I remember meeting this small handful of actors in the rehearsal room who did speak no English. And how I did it, I really don't know in retrospect. It must have been very strange. But after quite a short time, I formed, there was already something called the Theatre Workshop there, which consisted of several different theatre groups. So I formed one of them and worked with those actors and put on some productions there. It was a fantastic time.
And were you writing drama as well?
No, never. I never intended to write anything.
That's extraordinary. And yet, looking back, do you think that has fed into the poetry, that experience with the theatre?
Yes, I think so. Although I don't think it has anything to do with drama as such, but I think all the years of working with language, with scripts, and as an actor or director, most of the time you're reading between the lines.
Yes, yes.
And I think that actually did help a lot without my realising it.
Mm.
And of course, you know, at drama school and elsewhere, I've done a lot of verse drama, including Shakespeare. So
yes, yes.
That must have helped to feed metre into the bloodstream, I think.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the poems certainly read aloud very well. So tell me about the shift to poetry and how that happened. I think it was an Arvin course involved, wasn't there?
It was, yes. In fact, it was after I'd come back to England. I'd had two small children by that time, and I was on my own. And I couldn't do theatre work because I couldn't get a nanny and, you know, just the hours alone made it impossible. So my neighbour said, oh, why don't you go and do a script writing course? And she introduced me to Arvon, which I knew nothing about. So I did. I sort of booked into an Arvon course, which was script writing / poetry.
Yes.
And I got there, and it turned out, in fact, nobody was much interested in script writing. And they said, go and write some poems. So I went, no, all right then.
Remarkable.
Yeah. And I really knew nothing about her. I knew nothing about poetry. No. In fact, I knew nothing about writing. But that's how it started. And after about a year, I decided, oh, forget theatre. I'll go for this poetry thing.
And you seem to have taken, was it Seamus Heaney talked about one's childhood being one's capital. You seem to have taken that sort of Wordsworthian approach in much of your writing, looking back to your early years. Now, they were spent at the Isle of Wight, many of those early years, is that right?
They were, yes. Mm. I mean, I find childhood is definitely the wellspring, if you like,
yes, yeah.
And I constantly draw on it or go back to it.
Mm.
When I was six, I was sent to England from Tehran to boarding school in Shanklin, and I stayed there till I was about 16. So, yes, my entire childhood was there. But I think the thing that seemed to be most relevant to my poems and thinking was the fact that I lost my first language very quickly. Yes. So probably by about seven, I'd completely forgotten Farsi, which I'd never learnt to read and write in any way.
Yes.
And also during all my childhood, my family were not with me and I didn't go home for the holidays.
Yeah.
So I think that was that rupture, which actually many poets, I think, have in their early life.
Yes.
So it was losing the language, the family, the culture, the family history, all of that.
You know? So the influences on you are very much poets, like words with the
yes, the absolutely. Rather. They're all English because I can't read any to this day. I can't read Persian literature in the original.
No.
I have to get to it through translation.
But things like the Ghazal, and you've made a speciality of yours, and that, of course, is associated with the literature, I assume. So, formally, you've perhaps drawn on things from it.
I have, but it's a slight... it's not an intended deception, but I think it is a slight deception. Yeah. Because I think people think, oh, this is very innate to me or part of my culture.
Mm.
But in fact, it's really part of my general interest in forms.
Mm.
You know, I learned how to write, well, you know, to some extent, how to write sonnets or sestinas, villanelles, and they all come from different languages and cultures. So yeah. I approached the Ghazal really in the same spirit.
Yes. Sonnets you've been working on in the last period, and I think I read once that you said you detected a lack of anger in your work and that writing sonnets helped put that right. That's rather interesting. Could you elaborate on that a little?
Well, I once wrote a sequence. In fact, it was a heroic crown of sonnets, which is exceedingly difficult to do, and not many people even attempt it quite rightly, I think. I can't say it was very successful, but it was a sequence of English sonnets. And something about that couplet, that rhyming couplet at the end, gave me access, I think, to tones that I might well use frequently in life of anger or sarcasm or whatever, which I hadn't up to then been able to access. And I find forms generally will do that. They'll allow you to reach different parts of yourself and your voice. And that's why, partly why, I find them quite exciting.
Yes, yes. So what was the first poem where you really found your voice, would you say? Was it one of those Isle of Wight poems?
That's such an interesting and difficult question, because in a way I find I'm all the time finding my voice,
Perhaps a signature
but
poem.
I have a particular poem, which for me was when I first discovered really the magic properties of a form.
Yes.
I'd written a poem for my grandmother, which strangely was actually similar to the play script I'd taken to that original Arvon course.
Ah, so did read it.
Yes, it was, and it was the same material, the same theme and everything, but it was a lousy script. Anyway, I wrote it as a poem, and I wrote it with a certain rhyme scheme. It was, in fact, AAAX in quatrains, but it never worked, and I put it aside for about a year. And then one day I was in the bookshop, and you know how in secondhand bookshops there's always the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam.
Of course, yes.
So of course it was there, and I was staring at it, And for some reason, suddenly the penny dropped. And I thought, ah, I bet that poem of mine would like to be in the form of rubaiyat.
Wow.
And I went home. And within an hour, and I'd been slaving over this poem, trying to get it right, and suddenly it all fell into place.
And is this the poem called Rubaiyat?
Yes.
And that features
in quite a few. And that was a very early poem.
Yes.
And the first time I discovered, this is what form is all about. It actually helps you write the poem, rather than you've written it and then you want to squash it into some kind of form.
And the rest is history. Yeah. So do you think you've developed as a poet? I mean, looking back, if that's where you began. I certainly feel you have, reading through the books, but do you feel, and if so, in what ways have you developed as a poet, do you think?
Thank you very much. I'm glad you're saying that, because it would be awfully depressing to think I've not developed at all. I think with every book, I do have usually a particular objective, which is based on some kind of dissatisfaction with my writing. Hmm. I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean that in a productive way.
Hmm.
I tend to look at my writing and think, I need to work on this or I need to work on that. So, for example, my second book was very much trying to figure out how you write free verse. You
is that
know,
mirror
what
work?
It is in mirror work.
Mirror,
I mean, that was my own secret objective.
Mm.
And then some of the books would be dealing with, I think, the chine. I was trying to learn how to think in meter, which is quite difficult to do.
Yes. That was 2002, the chine, wasn't it? Yes.
That,
so tell us what a chine is, because you come back to that chine quite a lot. And
I have one called Shanklin Chine and one called The Chine.
Mm.
And the book is called The Chine.
So just tell us about the chine. What is a chine?
Okay, there's lots of things I really like about this word. First off, I like the fact that it's an English word, and a lot of English people don't know it, but I do.
That's always good for a
poet,
isn't
always
it?
Good.
Yes. It's like, again, Heaney's Omphalos.
Yes, exactly, exactly. So chines are quite common on the Isle of Wight and in the south of England. What they are is a gap or a kind of ravine where I think it's because the cliffs erode and then the stream will try and make a shortcut to the sea, as it were. So it creates this very steep ravine and you quite often have different vegetation there, semi-tropical. And Shanklin Chine particularly is quite a famous tourist place. It's very beautiful. And then my school, my boarding school, was called Upper Chine School.
Oh, was it?
Oh, yes, yeah. And the chine actually ran through the middle of the school grounds. And then also that rupture I was talking about in my early life, that is in a way a form of chine.
Mm-hmm.
And chine is also in butchering.
Of course, yes.
When you chine chops and things.
Yes.
So for me, it's quite symbolic.
And you do like these multiple meanings, don't you? The
more
I read your work, the more
actually,
I realise that. So the chine became a kind of totemic image for you.
Yes.
And some of your finest poems seem to return to that. Another thing that I came across that you said was about abstraction in poetry. You implied there was too much concrete detail in contemporary poetry. Would you like to elaborate a little on that?
I think it is, of course, one of the glories of English poetry that it is so full of marvellous concrete imagery and specificity. But at the same time, I think for those of us who've learnt how to write poems in a workshop culture, you know, we're endlessly told about, what is it, show don't, I get it wrong, show don't tell, don't we? I mean, ad infinitum. And I think it can be a stranglehold if applied exclusively.
Mm.
Because, in fact, looking at some of our greatest and most beautiful poetry is full of abstractions.
Yes.
But the thing is, they're very difficult to do.
Mm.
And very difficult to do well. And I often feel we're told rather than to keep trying and practicing to do the difficult, we're somewhat encouraged to not attempt it at all.
Mm. The Americans are very good at it, aren't they? You obviously like Louise Gluck, who is very good at doing that.
Yes,
and you wonder how on earth she manages it somehow. So has that been a conscious development in some of the recent books? Things like the Weather Wheel 2014 collection. That struck me as a little bit of a new direction. It seemed to be a mixture, actually, of abstraction and suddenly something very concrete, which I like a lot.
I do very much like mixing the two, having the balance. I mean, the concrete is the basis, you know, that's the ground floor, as it were, and you work with that, and occasionally you hope that, in fact, by being very specific, you can somehow go through the material world and emerge into something a little bit more abstract.
Yes. How do you feel about the early work? Now, looking back on those early books, White Ink, Mirror Work, Entries on Light, how do they feel sort of 20 years on or so? I mean, at a reading, would you still read from the early work or do you tend to go for the recent things?
That's such a good question, John, because I often wonder how other poets generally feel about their early work. I find a lot of it really embarrassing. I really do. I sort of squirm. I think, oh my God, that's awful, you know. Occasionally, I read something. I had to reread Entries on Light recently. I can't remember why. And I was not too dismayed. I thought, oh, some of this is quite nice.
I think it's a wonderful work.
Thank you.
It's interesting to me that in your different selected, you sort of paired it back and paired it back. You go back to the original and it's the richness there.
I think because I feel it's very much a sequence. I think it needs to be in one. And it's very difficult to extract from it, which is why I've tended not to for the selecteds. I feel every time it's extracted from, it sort of becomes less itself.
What's the attraction of a sequence then to a poet?
I think quite simply it's gives you more time to explore something. It relieves you of that pressure of time to do it all in one. So you can say, oh, I can just bite off as much as I can chew, a bit at a time.
Yes.
And look at this aspect, and then the next poem I can look at another aspect, and so on.
It's a little world to potter around in, like Keats.
It is, exactly.
Now, there's an elephant in the room, which is your interest in elephants. And I'll ask you about that. Several of your poems are about elephants, and I want to ask what it is about these elephants, which makes you return, for animals in general, but elephants particularly.
Yes, elephants. It's so funny, because, like everything, there's a wonderful Dick Davis translated, I wish I could quote it to you, a marvellous epigram from the Persian, from the medieval Persian. And it said something, I remember the last line says something, and all the rest was by accident. And I feel that this is like the keynote of my life, that all of it has really been by accident.
A good epigraph.
Yes, and the elephants were like this, because when I was 50... everyone suddenly arrived with cards and presents with elephants on them. And I remember actually saying, what is this with elephants? Are you all telling me I'm getting really old and wrinkly or something? Anyway, from there on, I had various elephants. And then other people got the idea that I liked elephants. So I've been blessed with endless presents of elephants ever since. And, of course, at one point, I myself got roped in. I thought, oh, OK, we best go with this. This is obviously it's meant.
Become an idée fixe,
yes,
as they say. Even one of your sestinas, motherhood, is one of the words, I think, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
One of the words, you have to
use
six words in a sestina, but six times. And elephant is one of them, ingeniously.
Yes. But
animals in general seem to be very important to you. They crop up everywhere in your poetry, I noticed.
I think I am. You know, the fact that we're losing so many species so rapidly, although I don't write about the environment directly in that way, it affects all of us, doesn't it? And I think for me, these animals, populate my mind in that spirit. It makes me feel I want to hold on to them. Although I myself am not really an animal person. I don't have pets. I had two cats because my children wanted them. But I would never choose to have one. I like animals to be in their own world.
But you write wonderfully about them. There's a wonderful mouse poem that opens one of the sequences, one of the books. And then the In Search of the Animals and the Weather Wheel opens. It's not that I went in search of the animals, though occasionally one crossed my path, which I like. Do you read reviews of your book?
Oh, yes, I do.
You do?
I do, yes. I wish I was one of those wonderful... who are you going to say?
I was going to say, like actors also. Oh, no, I never... never.
Oh, exactly. I'm sure there's some writers who say, oh, I never read reviews. Yeah.
Well, we're grateful for them when they come, aren't we?
God, I just fall on them, you know. Absolutely. Yeah. I do read them. I don't keep rereading them, especially not the bad ones.
No.
But they, you know, to have a good review is a wonderful blessing, really. I love the reviews from which I can learn something as well. And, you know, sometimes you gave me a wonderful review once.
Well, only because I like the book. I haven't had a chance to ask you about the poetry school, which is a remarkable thing to have founded. Could you say a little about that? What it is for people who don't know it?
The Poetry School is a national organisation which offers poetry courses of every kind of description, both short ones, long ones, and we have courses held, I suppose, mainly in London, but still all over the country, open to anybody who's interested in writing poetry.
So how did this come about? This
It came about... because I went to drama school, I think. Because when I was first told to go and write some poems, I thought, well, I don't know the first thing about it. And subsequent to that, I still didn't know the first thing about it. And, you know, you try and learn from handbooks and reading poems and a bit here in a workshop there, and I thought, this is so ad hoc and messy. And having done a wonderful training at a drama school... You see, I was thinking, but why is there no corollary, something structured that makes sense?
So again, the drama was fed into the poetry.
So it did feed into that. And at the time, myself and Jane Duran, we were running workshops at Torriano Meeting House. And then Pascal Petit joined us. And at some point, we wanted to get funding. So I suggested, why don't we set up a poetry school and start off with the workshops we already have and add courses and branch out from there. And the Arts Council were wonderfully supportive, and that's what we did. And it grew like wildfire.
It's been a phenomenon, really has. The other thing, I've got to ask you about this poet in residence, the Royal Mail. Now, what does that involve?
Do you remember when the Poetry Society were putting poets into very weird places?
Yes.
Under, sort of residence scheme. So I got the Royal Mail, which actually, I mean, I thought at first, oh my God, I'm going to go into post offices and, I don't know, write poems about postmen or something. The mind boggled. But in fact, I worked with the design department, who are the people who design the stamps. And they have a long tradition of a relationship with poets and poetry, not least Auden's Nightmare.
Of course, yes.
So it was absolutely wonderful. I spent, I think it was 6 months working with them. I did write some poems about writing letters, not about postmen, and learnt quite a lot about how the Royal Mail works, especially the design side of it, the stamps and so on. And it was very, very enriching for me. Yes,
was
it's
that
an experience.
Poem,
it was lovely.
Poem of yours about writing home
in
school, written at that time.
Yes,
that
writing lovely, lovely home, poem, yes. Writing letters and some other ones. Yeah. And one little tiny poem called Moving the Bureau, which in fact was commissioned for moving the I think it was the Philatelic Bureau in Edinburgh. They were moving offices. And so I wrote a poem on that occasion. But my case was just an actual bureau, a writing desk thingy.
So you never know where poetry is going to be found. Well, to round things off, what advice would you give to someone who is writing poetry, perhaps beginning to write poetry or would like to write poetry? Is there any sage advice you could give them?
Well, I do believe that there is an awful lot to learn. So however you can learn, through courses or workshops, but of course primarily through reading. So I would say read, 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 and not just contemporary stuff and not just old stuff. Mix it up. Read from other cultures, work in translation, you know, just as much as you can.
Yes.
I think one learns most really from the reading itself, but also all the other things I think are necessary, you know, and hugely helpful. And to join a community of poets in one way or another.
Mimi Calvati, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you very much, and John. It's a pleasure.
That was Mimi Calvati in conversation with John Greening. You can find out more about Mimi on her website at www.mimicalvati.co.uk. That's Calvati, spelt Khalvati. And that concludes episode 237, which was recorded by John Greening and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 238, Megan Delahunt speaks with Cherise Saywell about revolutionary beginnings, the physical nature of her writing and drafting process, being a citizen of nowhere, and the pressure on Australian writers to conform to colonial perceptions of their country. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.